Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is your Calls One Planet series. In her new book, Finding the Mother Tree, Discovering the Wisdom of the Forest, today's guest, forest ecologist Dr. Suzanne Simard, chronicles her life's work proving that forests are social, cooperative creatures connected through underground networks. Trees communicate their vitality and vulnerabilities with communal lives not that different from our own. She writes, quote, "We have the power to shift course. It is our disconnectedness and lost understanding about the amazing capacities of nature that's driving a lot of our despair. And plants in particular are objects of our abuse. By understanding their sentient qualities, our empathy and love for trees, plants, and forests will naturally deepen and find innovative solutions. Turning to the intelligence of nature itself is the key," end quote. Dr. Suzanne Simard is professor of forest ecology at the University of British Columbia and the leader of the Mother Tree Project, a research project investigating forest renewal practices that will protect biodiversity, carbon storage, and forest regeneration as the climate changing. Professor Simard is known for her work on how trees interact and communicate using below-ground fungal networks. Her TED Talks have been viewed by more than 10 million people around the globe, and you can find a few links at yourcallradio.org. Hi, Professor Simard. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, it's great to have you. You know, for people who don't know your story, they might be surprised to learn that you come from a logging family who ended up in British Columbia. In your introduction, you write, "For generations, my family has made its living cutting down forests. Our survival has depended on this humble trade. It is my legacy. I have cut down my fair share of trees as well." So can you start off by telling us a little bit about your family history?
Yeah, so my heritage is French Canadian, and so my family lived in Quebec, and they were loggers there, and then migrated across Canada in the late 1800s, and they landed in the interior wet belt forests, or the interior rainforests of British Columbia, which they were heading for California, but they ended up in, you know, up to their noses in snow, and they loved it. And my great grandfather then, you know, they basically homesteaded on the land and became horse log and continued their trade that they'd learned in Quebec, and were horse logging in the interior wet belt forests. And then that was handed down from generation to generation. And of course, over time, you know, forestry or forest harvesting became more mechanized, it moved away from being like supporting families, what we called gypo loggers back then, family operations, to bigger and bigger, to the point where now, where I live in British Columbia, the forests are regulated, and there's only a few large forest companies that, and these family operations really don't exist anymore. But that's where I came from. And I became a forester myself, but it was during the advent of the industrial age of forestry. And I think it was my background, you know, of seeing my grandfather logging in this very light touch manner, where he would just, you know, select the odd tree, to this wholesale clear cutting that is of modern day forestry, that really set me on the quest to figure out, you know, what are we doing here?
Well, right. And this is an important point to make, is that you write that your grandfather left the forest vibrant. He took only what he needed, leaving gaps so the trees could come back, which is such an important point to make, because then we learn about what happened when you worked for a logging company and how that just was not the case.
Yeah, and I think that we have to be super clear on this as a society, that the reason that, you know, clear cutting happens at this large scale that we do now is purely an economic reason. You know, you can find little ecological reasons to make great, big, vast clear cuts. You know, some used to say, well, it emulates wildfire. You know, it emulates natural disturbances. but really it doesn't. You know, it's different. It's, you know, when you add up the cumulative effects of extensive logging across landscapes, and in Canada, some of these clear cuts are enormous, you know, like 1,000 hectares. Mm. That doesn't occur in nature. So it is purely an economic thing. It's to make money. And it doesn't leave the same environment that, for example, that my grandparents created, I guess, if you will, by taking out selectively a few trees to feed the family. When you have a legacy of trees left behind and all the parts of the ecosystem, the plants, the soils, the slugs and the worms, when you leave those behind, the forest is poised to recover. And that is exactly what happens. But in a clear cut, it's an entirely different thing.
When you were 20, you worked a seasonal job for a logging company in the rugged Lillooet mountain range of Western Canada. And on your first day, you visited a clear cut. What do you remember about that day? And what can you tell us, those of us who maybe have never seen a clear cut? What does it look like? What does it feel like?
Yeah, it's kind of shocking, to be honest. Like a brand new clear cut is quite shocking. And it depends on all kinds of things, like how big it is, where it is. But, you know, when you go there, essentially, everything has been cut down. So all the trees have been cleared off. And in today's practice, where we use machines to go do that, like big feller bunchers and forwarders and skidders to move things around, they leave really nothing behind. You know, there's no small trees left behind. Most of the plants that were there have been crushed or ripped up. There are a sea of stumps left. There's slash remaining that, you know, so when you log, when a forest is clear cut, they're after the sound wood, of course, that will make, you know, big timbers and even pulp. But left behind, there's a lot left behind in slash. So that is like the rotten wood, the small wood, and actually the amount of wood on the ground increases a lot compared to a clear cut. So really what you're looking at right after clear cutting is a sea of stumps and piles of slash and not much, pretty much nothing green showing.
You know, I started reading your book on a camping trip to Humboldt State Park, and I was just surrounded by coastal redwoods. I highly recommend for anyone who wants to start Suzanne's book to take it somewhere where you're surrounded by trees, because I think it gives you just it's a different experience to read this book surrounded by actual trees. And reading some of these wayside exhibits, what is an old growth forest today? Only 4% of the original coast redwood forest remains. Now, for those who don't know that, you might think that this is just amazing. This has been here forever because it's so rich. But to think that only 4% of the original coast redwood forest remains, it's hard to even wrap your head around that.
It is. And I have to say, that's what we have up in the north as well in Canada. So this number, 3-4% left, what that means is that these huge forests in particular, the big iconic redwood forests or the cedar forests or the spruce forests, of course, those are the most lucrative forests too. Big trees make big money. And so, you know, when harvesting really started in earnest in the late 1800s along the West Coast, those were the trees, the big valley bottom, huge trees that loggers and then eventually the big corporate companies went after. And so these iconic big valley bottom forests are reduced to the 2-3% or 4% in the redwood case remaining. That's exactly what we find in Canada and in British Columbia as well. And so what does that mean? It means that, that the landscape has dramatically changed, and there's all kinds of implications for this, you know, so we can talk about this further, but I'll just name a few things. So those big old growth forests, they're enormous carbon sinks, or they were. And now, you know, as we've removed these forests to make, for various reasons, our forests in general, the forest lands have moved from being carbon sinks for, you know, carbon sinks. That means that they draw down CO2 from the atmosphere in photosynthesis to now they're sources of carbon, where as it's getting warmer and there's fewer forests, they're actually emitting more carbon dioxide than they're taking in. And that's a huge shift. The other thing to think about is these old iconic forests are also where we have a lot of biodiversity and rare and endangered species that only live in old growth forests. And so those are also hugely impacted. In fact, you know, forestry is one of the main causes, or clear cut harvesting, of loss of biodiversity worldwide. And then I guess another thing to think about is that these old, old trees, these vast, huge forests, they also are, you know, they can be thousands of years old. You know, in our West Coast forests in British Columbia, some of the trees are 2,000 or 3,000 years old. And so that means that they've been around for a long time and seen all kinds of climatic variations, which is encoded in their DNA. And the seeds then also hold that experience, if you will, of seeing climatic variation, that then the seedlings that are produced are resilient to various climatic extremes. And when you lose that seed bank, you also lose that resilience of those plants to withstand or to cope with climate change moving forward.
Today, we are speaking with Dr. Suzanne Simard, author of The Mother Tree, Discovering the Wisdom of the Forest. If you have any questions or comments for Suzanne about her work and the importance of forests. Forests are social, cooperative creatures connected through underground networks. Trees communicate their vitality and vulnerabilities with communal lives not that different from our own, which when you just sit back, it's amazing to think about. You can give us a call at 866-798-8255. 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. It was fascinating to read about your experience working in the logging industry and then learning about what happens when these old groves are cut, what happens to the underground network of trees and fungi that depend on these incredible trees. So can you take us through part of that process, how you came to connect all of these dots?
Yeah. So, you know, I've painted kind of this picture of what's going on in our forests and how, you know, as a young woman growing up that came from a deep forest, an inland rainforest. And then it became a forester in this new era where the forest has become more a commodity and we're not caring for our forests so that they remain vital, that I wanted to understand what it was that we were dismantling here. And always with the thought that, can we do this better? Can we save these pieces so that our forests can rebound and be regenerative and, you know, continue to provide the life-sustaining resources that we need, like clean air and clean water? And, you know, that's where we get this from. Our healthy lives come from healthy forests. And so I started looking at, you know, what is it that we're dismantling below ground? And what got me on that path is that I started to see in the plantations that we were replacing old growth forests with, that they weren't very healthy and they weren't very productive. I mean, they seemed so okay at first, but I started noticing that, you know, especially as it's getting warmer and the climate is changing, that these forests are actually quite vulnerable. They're getting infections from diseases and insect infestations. In fact, that by the time they're 20 years old, about half the trees I've found in my studies are infected to the point where they're not going to become big old trees in the future. And so so I started looking at what we were doing, and I found, you know, below ground, I was building on the research of many others that knew that mycorrhizas, which are a certain kind of fungus that lives in the forest. It's a type of a fungal group. And there are thousands and thousands of species of these mycorrhizal fungi in the world, like literally tens of thousands. And there are, you know, hundreds of thousands of all kinds of fungi all over the world that include saprotrophs and endophytes and pathogens. But I was looking at this kind called mycorrhizas. And these are really symbiotic fungi that join with the roots of trees, and all trees all over the world do this in order to carry out their life cycle. And what the trees do is they provide photosynthetic carbon or energy to the fungus that it then uses that to grow its mycelium through the forest floor. And as it does that, it picks up nutrients and water, even breaks down carbon in the soil to get up phosphorus and nitrogen. And then it delivers those nutrients, those essential nutrients, back to the tree in trade for more photosynthate. And so the fungus gets energy because it can't photosynthesize itself, and the tree gets its nutrients at a cheaper cost, energetic cost, than it would to grow roots to do that. Roots require lignin and cellulose, and that's energetically very expensive to build. So it's much more efficient for them to join into this partnership. This symbiosis has been around for millions of years. In fact, it was like about 300 or 400 million years ago that an arbuscular mycorrhiza joined in a symbiosis with plants that were migrating onto land, and that allowed these land plants to really get a hold and start extracting and breaking down, you know, rock and being able to live on the terrestrial environment. So it's been a fundamental relationship that's given, you know, the ability for plants and trees to evolve and to create oxygen for humans and all, you know, the higher level organisms to evolve eventually in an oxygenated environment. Okay, so they're fundamental. So I was looking at these fungi. I'd learned that they can actually, you know, from lab studies in the UK, a professor, David Reed, had looked in the lab and found that these mycorrhizal fungi could actually join different pine seedlings together. And he labeled one with carbon dioxide, carbon 14, one seedling, and watched that tracer, that radioactive tracer, move right into its neighbor through this mycorrhizal network. And so I thought, wow, you know, could that be one of the fundamental foundations of the forest? And maybe we're ripping it apart when we're doing this clear-cut logging. And so I started studying it, and I found that in our natural forests, they're full of these mycorrhizal networks, right? All the trees are actually joined together in this massive network that helps seedlings regenerate. They are able to trade carbon and nutrients back and forth. It really creates a balance in the forest and this great springboard for seedlings to emerge from. And when you clear cut a forest, basically what happens, and you think about those fundamental processes, is that the tree is gone, the photosynthesis is, the leaves are gone, there's no photosynthesis. And so those fungi actually slowly die because they can't get the energy that they need from the trees. But they don't all completely die off, in that when the forest starts to regenerate, if it will regenerate within a year, the fungi that are coming in by spores or are remaining in the soil as hyphae will start to colonize those new sprouts. So the new seedlings, any plants are able to emerge, they'll join in and they'll start to colonize those seedlings. The diversity of those fungi, though, is a lot less than in the old growth forests that these seedlings are replacing. So a plantation with, say, one species planted back will have only a handful of mycorrhizal fungal species, whereas an old growth forest will have 100. So the diversity of fungi is way lower, which, of course, affects the functioning of the forest.
So in addition to clear cutting, obviously, ruining this relationship, you write that it's also ruined with fertilizer and irrigation in the seedling nursery. So can you talk more about that?
Yeah. So think about, you know, evolution is about, you know, survival of the fittest, if you will. And that means, you know, that a species is able to carry out its life cycle. It's able to, you know, reproduce, grow, set seed, reproduce again, and carry on and evolve and mutate and adapt to environments. So if say, you know, a tree enters into this symbiosis, and that's it helps it evolve, right? It is a fitness process. It's helping the tree be fit by joining in into the symbiosis, and the tree will invest in that because it increases fitness. So it invests its energy into this symbiosis. But let's say you add, you know, you actually add all of the things that symbiosis does for you. So what the tree is getting out of it is water and nutrients gathered up from the soil. Well, if you're adding water and nutrients as fertilizer in irrigation, the tree will no longer invest in that symbiosis. And so it sheds its mycorrhizal fungus. And so in a nursery setting, a lot of plants are watered and fertilized, and they look great in the nursery. And, you know, but when you plant out these seedlings in a clear cut, for example, you know, Douglas fir in particular is very stark that there are no mycorrhizas on those seedlings because they've had everything given to them. And so when they're planted out, it takes a while for the fungi to actually recolonize those plants. And, you know, in a forestry setting, you know, usually, you know, they will become colonized again. So there's no problem with that. They will actually become colonized by fungi that are remaining around. It's a simpler community, which has its knock-on effects. But if you think of it in an agricultural field where fertilizers and irrigation is added all the time, you know, in those settings, even most of our agricultural plants are also reliant on mycorrhizas. So whether they're, you know, corn plants or soybeans or you know, alfalfa, they have mycorrhizal symbionts as well. If you're constantly adding fertilizer and irrigation, they shed their mycorrhizas. And so then you lose your irrigation and fertilizers, or if there's some kind of extreme events. So if there's extreme climatic events, you know, then that's where where the rubber hits the road, because those plants don't have mycorrhizas. And so then they can't actually help those plants because they're not there. They've been fertilized and irrigated out of the system. So it really, you know, going back to sort of like agroforestry or more sustainable agriculture or no-till agriculture is where you can actually sustain these natural symbionts and you'd have a healthier and more resilient agricultural setting as well.
You know, reading your book, going from this amazing forest and Humboldt and then driving through cities and just seeing maybe a single amazing tree with not that much around it, it just made me wonder, the trees in the forest are one thing when you think about this amazing underground channel. What about the trees in cities that might just be on their own?
I know, it's like kind of a lonely world. You know, trees are incredible. Obviously, they survive in cities. I mean, they are very social creatures. And I think we forgot that when we made cities, that trees are social. They love their neighbors, neighboring trees of different species, of the same species. They love being around with other plants around them. They thrive in those conditions. You know, a park is much more healthy than a single tree on a boulevard. And we can create those conditions in cities. And I think that, you know, we can change how we've designed cities so that we do that. So instead of having like, you know, one tree that's surrounded by cement, which you often see in cities, even like with a little, you know, hardly any soil or, you know, any air getting into that soil. You know, that's a pretty tough environment for a tree, but we can recreate these spaces so that there's multiple plants and that they can connect with each other and that they can communicate with each other. And that's they'll be more resilient. Like, so when there is a drought or when there is a windstorm or a flood or something, they have their neighbors to help sustain, like they can work as a community to survive that event.
It's just really amazing information. And we humans are pretty funny, because just to think that trees have, you know, they work with each other. They like having neighbors. They feed their children, which we'll talk about after the break, ensure that they have enough water. We say, isn't that amazing? As if we're the only ones. And I know that, you know, animal knowledge has changed so much and people understand that now. But just thinking about that applying to trees and plants is just incredible, but humans are funny like that. Today we are joined by Dr. Suzanne Simard, professor of forest ecology at the University of British Columbia, and we're talking about her incredible work and her best-selling book, The Mother Tree, Discovering the Wisdom of the Forest. This is Your Calls One Planet series. We'll be back after this. This is Your Calls One Planet series. I'm Rose Aguilar, and we just wanted to let you know a programming note. The January 6th hearings, the time has changed again. So the next hearings will be tomorrow at 10 a.m. Pacific time. So that means we will be carrying the hearings through this show. And then when there is a break, we'll have a guest to analyze the latest. So again, tomorrow, starting at 10 a.m. Pacific, we will be carrying the January 6th hearings with a break for analysis. So we hope you can join us for that. Today is our One Planet series. As you know, every Monday we talk about our precious planet and the climate crisis. And today we're spending the hour with Dr. Suzanne Simard, professor of forest ecology at the University of British Columbia, author of the best-selling book, The Mother Tree, Discovering the Wisdom of the Forest, and leader of the Mother Tree Project. This is a research project investigating forest renewal practices that will protect biodiversity, carbon storage, and forest regeneration as the climate changes. You know, Suzanne, before the break, I was just talking about how we humans are pretty funny. I mean, we're learning so much now about just how smart animals are. We've known about it with dolphins for many years. We're now learning about pigs and octopus, for example. And I wonder, when you first started talking about trees and the communication between trees, the older trees passing on knowledge to younger trees, how did people respond in the beginning?
Well, I think a lot of skepticism at first. And just keep in mind, I started this work in the early 1990s, and other people were working alongside in different labs around the world, kind of uncovering the wisdom of plants. And so it was kind of, you know, new to a lot of people. And I'm sure all those other researchers encountered the similar resistance and skepticism that I did. But, you know, over time, like it was kind of rough at first. Like I think it took maybe 20 years before it came to the public consciousness that, you know, this new research showing that plants actually communicate not just through below ground fungal networks that I was studying, but also through the air. And forests are highly communicative places. And when we analyze, you know, what that looks like, it's like this vast internet between trees, both above and below ground. And so I think when people can visualize what that might look like, and now that we have the internet, and it's kind of interesting that, you know, that the invention of the World Wide Web in the late 1980s and early 1990s was at exactly the same time that we were discovering the Wood Wide Net, which or the Wood Wide Network, which is, it's kind of interesting that they moved along in parallel. And I think that the fact that people could envision the World Wide Web, that it helped them envision the Wood Wide Web, that, you know, that when you can see these parallels and understand them, then it's easier for people to absorb that information. But certainly at first it was like, what? Mm-hmm.
Well, so let's talk a little bit about this. The older trees first, they're able to discern which seedlings are their own kin. The older trees nurture the young ones and provide them with food and water, just as we do with our children. You write, it's enough to make one pause, take a deep breath, and contemplate the social nature of the forest and how mm-hmm. this is critical for evolution.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so we started out really just, you know, first of all, we understood this network existed and it linked together trees of different species and different plants. And then we started looking at, you know, uncovering the network in old forests and realizing that the structure of that old forest with old trees and young trees coming up underneath them, that these young trees were establishing within this great big network of the old trees. So the old trees are supporting this vast fungal network with all these different species. And it was, you know, and these seedlings that they would shed, you know, their seeds would shed on the ground, the seedlings would germinate, and they would get colonized by this huge network supported by the old trees. And then we started doing research on, you know, where we would label the older seedlings and older trees with different isotopes, carbon, nitrogen deuterated water and just watch where it went. And we found that these nutrients were passing from the older trees into these younger seedlings, and that this was actually, you know, helping, it seemed to be helping these seedlings establish and grow. And so the next question then seemed kind of obvious. Well, can these older trees, actually discern which of these seedlings that are getting facilitated, getting help, can they discern which ones are of their own kin, which seemed like a good evolutionary question to ask. And so we did a whole bunch of studies, a few of my grad students and I, on kin recognition in trees, which had been an emerging study in plants with some other researchers in the East, Susan Dudley and others who are working with small sea plants. And so I started working with this too with my grad students, and we found that they actually can. They can discern which are their own kin and which are not. And the way we figured this out is that we would grow older seedlings with younger ones in the lab and then in the field, and we would have them have them as full siblings, and then compare how these old trees interacted with them compared to stranger seedlings that came from other trees. And then we had them connected to networks and not connected to networks. These mycorrhizal networks. And we found that the sibling seedlings, the same offspring, that they grew faster, they survived better, they had better nutrition, they had more mycorrhizal fungi, and that when we labeled the parent tree, that they actually sent more carbon to these kin than to the strangers. And so that was basically how we were able to determine that these trees can recognize and actually change it changes the interactions with how those trees how they behave with their neighbors. That actually affects how they will interact with a neighbor, whether they're kin or strangers.
Wow. Well, if you have any questions or comments for Dr. Suzanne Simard, author of The Mother Tree, Discovering the Wisdom of the Forest, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. So thinking about the Mother Tree, you started the Mother Tree Project, and it consists of 9 experimental forests located across a climate rainbow in British Columbia, from hot and dry forests in the southeast corner of the province to cold and wet areas in the north central interior. So can you tell us more about this project?
Yeah, this has been occupying my time for the most part for the last number of years, and all my graduate students are working on this. So what we wanted to do was, how can we manage our forests better, right? Like, is there an alternative to clear cutting that will actually conserve carbon, help species, you know, be conserved, so where we don't lose the fungi, we don't lose the lichens and mosses, and it actually will help forests regenerate as climate changes. And we use this climate gradient as kind of a space for time experiment where, you know, instead of watching climate get hotter and drier, we could actually compare cooler, wetter sites with hotter, drier sites to try to predict how those cooler, wetter sites will behave in the future. And how can we, you know, how can we care for those forests so that they continue to have all of these, you know, great functions and great structures that we know are important? So we created these 9 experimental forests, or we went into these 9 experimental forests. We're collaborating with forestry companies. We're collaborating with First Nations, with research forests, community forests. Whoever wants to collaborate with us, we create an experimental forest there, and we try different ways of saving these old trees while still harvesting some trees around them. So we'll compare a clear cut with where we retain, you know, 20 trees per hectare or 20 mother trees per hectare, or that would be like, about 25 per acre. Where we retained 30% of the trees in clusters, where we retained 60% of the mother trees, and then thin from below, and then compare that to not cutting any forests. And we're finding some amazing stuff, right? I think the first thing that I can share with people is that, you know, when we don't harvest forests, that's where we're able to retain the most carbon, like straight across the board. right? Like leaving forests uncut is where we actually mitigate carbon emissions, and we can keep those carbon sinks in the ground and in the forest. And so the first lesson for us there is that we really need to protect the remaining forests that we have, especially the old growth forests, because there are our natural sinks for carbon dioxide. And as we clear cut them, we're actually exacerbating climate change. We're making it worse. So we really need to, you know, make some hard decisions here, but we need to do this. This is our life, right? This is our next generations. So where do we get wood from? Well, we can actually do some harvesting, in especially in second growth forests, and we can do what we call partial retention. And our, so that means leaving, you know, a lot of the old mother trees behind, most of them actually. And what that provides is, you know, it saves the mycorrhizal diversity, it saves the fungal and lichen diversity in the forest, and it provides seed for the next generations. And we're able to retain a good portion of the carbon, and they recover actually a lot faster. So instead of taking, you know, 100 years or 200 years for a clear cut to recover, they'll recover their carbon stocks within 30 or 50 years. That's a huge difference, especially when, given that, you know, the IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, has told us we only have, you know, 10 years or less to change this, to act. And so this is an easy solution to climate change, is we, you know, and I think, you know, and people will think, well, where are we going to get our toilet paper from? Where are we going to buy our houses, get our houses from? There are alternative products out there. You know, you don't have to get, you know, a package that's got cardboard made from an old growth forest. You know, a lot of the stuff coming from Amazon, for example, it comes from old growth forests, those cardboard boxes. Well, there's alternative packaging that can be used. You know, we don't have to use so much toilet paper. We can make, you know, there are alternative fibers that can be used. And I think, you know, there's a lot of science out there to inform that. So those are some of the results that we're finding, and they're important results that really show the way, help us show the way forward.
The Amazon packaging comes from old growth forests?
Part of it does. I mean, their supply chain is not very clean. Like, you know, it comes from a variety of sources, but some of it comes from old growth forests.
Oh my gosh. I'm so glad you brought that up, because we've done these very, I have to say, surreal shows around the holidays when cities just don't have the space for all of this recycled cardboard, because people are getting, I mean, it's incredible that these trucks are in neighborhoods multiple times a day, and this package, I just didn't know it came from old growth forest. That needs to get more attention.
It definitely does. And it's actually, it's been brought up to Amazon. They're aware of it. And I think, but when you look at their policies, it says they are, you know, try to reduce that. But we really need to hold them to task and make sure, you know, that moving forward that they don't do this. But honestly, I mean, and until people really stand up, especially with their consuming habits, I guess, it's going to continue, because it's so embedded in the supply chain. So when you're, you know, in British Columbia, we're looking at like whole forests coming down every day. And most of those products that come out of the forest are turned into toilet paper and cardboard. Only about 35% is turned into long-term storage products like furniture and houses. So a good part of it is just like basically vaporized into the atmosphere. And it's because we have this fast and ready lifestyle of, oh, I'm just going to order it from Amazon, or I'm just going to use all this paper or whatever. We really need to clean up these supply chains so that we don't do this.
Right. To your last point, we have a related question from a listener who says, what will it take to learn from past disasters like clear cutting? How can we save what's left?
Well, we know now, right? And I think that the science is very solid on this. And climate change science is very solid that, you know, that we have human-caused climate change. We're all pretty much everybody in the world is experiencing this, some worse than others. We know the solutions that if we stop clear cutting our old growth forests, if we restore the forests that we have clear cut so that they're diverse and vibrant and full of species, that we know that carbon sequestration is correlated with species diversity. And we have we have knowledge of how to restore these forests. We can, and it takes people, and it takes people being in their forests and working with their forests and investing in communities that know how to do this, that want to do this. And it will help the entire world to get back on track to start absorbing, or, you know, allowing photosynthesis, which is the only proven method of really sequestering excess carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. It's the only proven method that's highly evolved. We need to be working on restoring these forests. And so, you know, we just need, and one way we can do this. So it's like the economy right now is all set up to cut down our forests, right? We valued trees for 2x4s and pulp and paper. It's the only price we've put on forests. We don't put a price on, you know, their CO2 sequestration ability, for example. We don't put a real price on carbon. But once we start to do that, if we tax carbon or we get into carbon offsets, and we know that if we save carbon in these forests, we can actually change the economy so that saving forests makes more economic sense than cutting them down. So the solutions exist. We just got to get our politicians on board. And in order to get the politicians on board, the public has to be on board. And I think it's really about knowing, right, and being educated and teaching and learning from forests and each other and getting the word out there.
We have a question from another listener who says, please ask Professor Simard, said trees communicate through the, oh, right. Ask Professor Simard. She said trees communicate through the air, not just through their roots. Can you please explain that?
Yeah. So this isn't my area of research, but there are other people around the world who are investigating this. So the first work came from, I think it's Richard Carbon's lab in California. And he was looking at how when trees were injured or infested with an insect, that they emitted volatile organic compounds, basically just little chemicals in the air that served as messengers of information to neighboring trees who picked up these messages. They could detect these compounds in the air that were kind of like warning signals. And the trees that received the messages were actually able to increase their resistance against those insects that were being herbivores on their neighbors. And so it really is like the volatiles, as you're walking in a forest, like you're smelling all kinds of fragrances from the flowers, the cones, the resins. But some of those fragrances are actually these VOCs that are basically information signals that are moving back and forth between the trees, warning each other about dangers that are affecting them and their neighbors.
That's amazing. If the trees could talk and if the animals could talk, can you just imagine all the knowledge they would share with us and the warning signs?
It's complex, right? It's highly complex, which makes it so interesting. Mm. And there was a recent study I read where people were actually detecting electrochemical signals through fungi, and they were mapping these signals. So through the mycelium that, you know, that can connect trees. And they were mapping the electrochemical signals. And they said that the complexity of the signal was equivalent to, you know, a language like Greek and Italian. And so, you know, as we look further and further, we find out that the language that they're using, that these, it's highly complex. And really, if you stand back and think about it, you know, these plants, they grow in one place, they can't move around, and they're surrounded by neighbors. They live their whole life around their neighbors. Why wouldn't they be interacting and communicating with each other? It actually makes sense.
It really makes a lot of sense. And the one thing that we didn't have much time to talk about, to learn more about, it's H-U-M-U-S. How do you say that? Pronounce that?
Humus.
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 So, yeah, this is another important one. And we only have a few minutes, but it's basically nature's compost, the dead plants, the bugs, all of this is buried there. The trees love to root there, not so much above or below it, because there they can access the bounty of nutrients. And it just speaks to the importance, again, of all of this, it's connected, and the importance of healthy soil.
Yeah. And yeah, I mean, most of this, the life in the soil, the soil organisms, the soil food web, which is like a food chain, lives in that humus layer. That's that organic layer that is on the, in the forest floor, or if you're in a prairie, it's that topsoil. It's rich with nutrients, carbon, and life. And so that's the part that is so important to protect. In our forests in Canada, about half of the carbon in the soil is in that humus layer. And it's really vulnerable to disturbance and destruction by industrial activities. And so, yeah, it's really important to protect it. And then also, if you're trying to restore a forest or a garden or a, or, you know, any kind of terrestrial ecosystem, that compost, that nature's compost, is where the life is. That's where you start from. That's the building blocks of creating a new plant community.
Professor Simard, 30 seconds, your final thoughts. With the climate crisis, the fires, the pesticides, on and on and on. What do you think is the most effective thing people could do at this point to save these trees and to ensure that we take on the climate crisis?
It's so important that we understand how important the forests are. And so the first thing is to protect the old growth forests that are remaining. That is absolutely number one. So if you see a forest being cut down in your area, go and ask, like, what is going on here? And make your voice heard, because it's only people speaking out that's going to stop the business as usual, which has been going on for the last century. And it's not easy to stop that. There is going to be huge resistance, because there's all kinds of things put in place to maintain the status quo. So speaking out about harvesting of old growth forests is absolutely crucial. And then also supporting a carbon tax that means something, or, you know, and that carbon tax can flow back into protecting and restoring our forests. Of course, it can also flow back to social services, just like, you know, harvesting taxes flow into providing social services, so can carbon taxes that actually support maintaining and restoring forests. So I think, you know, making sure your politicians understand this and then pushing them to make sure, or to ensure that they act and that they don't back down on their word.
Well, Professor Simard, it's an amazing book. Huge respect and thanks for your work. We would love to have you back. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. Dr. Suzanne Simard is professor of forest ecology at the University of British Columbia and author of, it's actually a really beautiful memoir, The Mother Tree, Discovering the Wisdom of the Forest. You can find more information about Dr. Simard's work and watch her TED Talk at yourcallradio.org. Thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Calls One Planet series.